I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode.
We ask now is, if I take away your track record, what's your story? What's your story? And it's striking how many owners, operators, managers do not have a good answer to that. They've relied on a strong track record for 10 years, but if you take it away, what do you stand on and how do you separate yourself from the competition?
I'm Brandon Sedloff, Chief Real Estate Officer and host of the Distribution Podcast by Juniper Square. On today's episode, I sit down with Deborah Smith, founder and CEO of CenterCap Group, a leading boutique investment bank and placement agent focused on the commercial real estate sector. We discuss Deb's professional journey into real estate, the dynamics of the booming M&A market, and the importance of manager strategy differentiation and more. Let's get into it. Can you start by introducing yourself and give us a little bit of background on kind of who you are and what you do at a high level, and then we'll unpack a little bit more of your history.
Sure. I am the co-founder and CEO of the CenterCap Group, which is a boutique investment bank focused entirely on the real estate sector. We've been around since 2009. Pre that, I've been a career investment banker. I was at the bulge brackets for a number of years doing energy, utilities, power, before going over to the buy side and acting as the global head of M&A for CBRE Investors. And from there, I started up our firm with a partner. So we're women-owned to this day and still living the dream of working in investment banking.
So take us back to kind of life before being an investment banker. I believe you grew up on a farm in Australia. What was that like and how did that path lead you to where you are today?
Yeah, fortuitously, it's no grand plan, no grand scheme, being right placed at the very, very right time. I did indeed grow up a dairy farmer's daughter. I moved around a lot as a child with no real ambition or expectation I would ever go to university, my wildest dreams. Just fortuitously, a long list of mentors that started in high school saw some potential and said I should go to university. So I worked hard and I made it in. And from there, same thing, I had a really good mentor who directed me through my college degree. I did a double in economics law at University of Sydney and graduated with honors in both. And with plans to be a tax lawyer, I somehow fell into an investment banking position at Morgan Stanley, who shifted me over to the US, and the rest has been history. I was sent as a loner and never went home.
So you joined Morgan Stanley, I believe, in 1998. What was the kind of institutional landscape like when you started your career?
It was interesting because back then, you know, I started out doing privatizations in power. And I worked on the privatization of the South Australian power grid as my very first job with Morgan Stanley, which was very interesting because I lived in a hotel for a year, was sent to Adelaide, got an apartment in Melbourne, which is where we largely were at Morgan Stanley at the time. And I spent a New York minute in it. I was shipped off to South Australia, and from South Australia was shipped over to the US and came over here as a power banker working on power deals, and Morgan Stanley had a phenomenal franchise in that sector. And it was right before the dot-com. And I actually remember being that analyst that had to come into the office the year 2000 because we were worried about what would happen with the computers. We laugh about it now. You and I can laugh about it now. But back then, it was one of my jobs to make sure the world didn't blow up. And so I look back fondly on those days, but it was right before the dot-com, which put a crazy change on the world back then.
So as you were kind of doing the banking, what made you want to move? You know, it seems like you were a generalist or at least not a real estate specialist. And then eventually you landed at CBRE. Kind of what precipitated or prompted that move?
Yeah, I actually didn't know anything about real estate and had no intentions to be in real estate. It's another one of those fortuitous things. Is I had moved over to Wachovia in 2005 with a dream of working on healthcare. Is I had worked on healthcare services when I went through the ACP program at Morgan Stanley, the accelerated path from analyst to associate. And I worked on some things in healthcare and I loved it. And so that's what I wanted to do. And so Morgan Stanley did not have a big franchise in the services part of it. And that's really what I wanted to do. And so I went over to Wachovia thinking that's what I would be doing. And it just happened to be, for the folks that are listening, 2005, which was, guess what? It was the big takeoff year of go privates for the real estate industry. And so I worked on a healthcare deal and then I was put on the Gables go private and have been working on real estate ever since. That was the first one, and then the rest came and followed.
Interesting. And so then eventually you moved over to CBRE. What is the kind of, I think you called it the acquisition or the M&A or the banking desk at CBRE. What did that look like? And, you know, a lot of us know CBRE today, you know, kind of big green machine, a lot of service lines. So tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, I moved over after the Adjutant Smith, which was the last thing I worked on, which is, I remember the timing well from Lehman. And it was just an extraordinary opportunity. I wasn't really looking. It fell into my lap to interview for it. And I met the folks over at the CBRE on the investor side. And I think we were around 25 billion assets under management. And I think the goal was to do corporate level deals. They had a very strong office industrial through the strategic partners series. And it was looking at expanding that product offering. And so it was a super unique opportunity. I was in my 30s to take that job on. And we sat above the funds. They had global Asia, Europe, UK, US, reported directly into the CEO. It was an extraordinary experience. And, you know, they had raised the largest value-add fund in 2008. And so was there for that. And it was an extraordinary time. And then, of course, Lehman collapsed right after I left. So Lehman collapsed, Bear Stearns collapsed. And I feel like I went on vacation and came back and the two banks weren't there anymore. And you know, it was very interesting time because in the mornings, I felt like it was problem solving. You know, our team was an independent team because we didn't sit within any of the investment programs. And so we were the independent group that could look at things from an external third-party perspective. And that was fantastic. You know, we got to look at all the different funds, really get inside of what made them tick on behalf of investor reviews during that period. But in the afternoons, we had raised a lot of capital. So it was looking for new opportunities that we could deploy into. And it was that barbelled. It was such a challenging, but at the same time, a very, very exciting time to be on the buy side.
So, and we'll come back to a lot of, I think, what you learned during those experiences, and perhaps, you know, you can share a little bit more about kind of some of the lessons learned. But you left CBRE to start your own firm, I believe, in 2009. It's an interesting time to go out on your own, obviously, you know, coming out of or still kind of in the depths, if you will, of the global financial crisis. What was the motivation there and kind of what was your thesis? What did you want to do when you set out to start your own boutique investment bank?
Crazy. In retrospect, I'm not sure I would have told my younger self to have done it at all. Who starts an investment bank in the middle of the GFC? Nobody that crazy does that. It's so we had received a call from one of the big managers who wanted some assistance on figuring out how to take over another vehicle. And even at CB, we were still bankers, but we were internalized. Our team was an internal banking team. And so that's what I've always done. And that's what I love to do, is to advise companies and help them grow and help them figure out how to be better versions of themselves. And we know we call it tactical advice, but it's an approach that I love to do without quite being a management consultant. And so I really enjoy it. And so when we started at CCG, this company needs our help. Let's just give it a whirl and let's just see what happens. And it was a little bit like that. And then it kind of just snowballed. One thing led to the next thing, led to the next. And then the next thing you know, we need an office. And again, one of the big owner operators, fund managers, gave us some office space because it was like, well, we need an office. They gave us a printer for $50 and it was, and then we're off to the races. And then I was like, well, now we need people. And then we got involved in the Campus Crest IPO process, which led again. But what we found through all of it is that, I thought I knew a lot, and I thought I knew a lot of people when I was in the bulge bracket banks. I really did. And what I realized after I got to CBs, I really didn't know that much at all. I just thought I did. And when you look at it from a different perspective, and you look at it from the buyer's idea that not every deal is a good deal, and if you do something, you have to own it. You don't get to hand it off and walk home and collect your check and be done. And I think that that period, even though it was short, had a really influential impact on how I view the world and how we give advice to clients through to this day. And so now it's like, well, would I do this deal? Do I like this deal? Do I think this is a good opportunity? Because I want the deal to work. I want it to be successful. And I want those folks that we work with to continue on. And that perspective I learned from CB, being with some very smart people. They gave us latitude and said, all right, well, if you all want to work on this, okay, work on it. And we got a wake-up call on that. It was a welcome to the buy side when we realized that if we were going to pull the trigger on something, we had to own it. And that really changes your mind on whether you think you should do something. And so that's carried with us. And so that's the way we've developed and how we grew the business around that perspective of whether we like it and whether we would do it ourselves.
So from a practical perspective, you've been in the industry for, kind of 20 years focused on real estate. It wasn't that long ago that real estate wasn't even an institutional asset class. So help me understand kind of the arc of how buy side and banking advisory, the kind of transactions have evolved from, when you first got into the business with, Wachovia/CBRE through to today. And then we can go back and talk a little bit more about what it is that CenterCap does for your clients and how that all works.
So we started out coming from the bigger banks. Your focus really was on REITs. And, when we moved over to Lehman, from Wachovia, again, it was focused on the REIT universe. And where the bulge brackets will always have a leg up over boutiques is their capacity to lend. And real estate is a leverage-driven business. It is. And that's how we make the economics work. And so what we realized is that when you're at the bulge brackets and the companies are very large, that when you underwrite, it is very difficult for bigger firms to really get super granular on companies, on their business, because they have thousands of assets. How are you going to underwrite thousands of assets if you're running a process or even if you're on the buy side? I had been in opportunities where, there's only so much you can do in order to get at the type of granularity that we get in now. And I thought we were granular. But our clients today in the boutique world, they expect me to know all the way down to the asset. And I'll never be as good as an owner operator or the person who owns it. I will never be that good. But as a result, I'm better than your average banker. So I understand at a much greater degree that I can look at an asset and I can look at an opportunity and think whether I think it can be successful or not, or to ask the right questions around leasing and rental and markets and dollars per pallets and cold storage. Is we get to learn a lot more because the clients can be smaller, and middle market clients, even at $10 billion of AUM, you know, or 15 billion of AUM. You really can dig very deeply into their business. And so as a result, for us, you know, I have the skill to look at things from a big picture perspective, which I got from the bigger banks. But now I know how to take that and really drill it down to a very granular level. And so that our advice, which I think that we give to our clients, is much more informed. It's much more tactical and it's much more strategic because we get so involved in our clients' organizations at a deep level.
So you talked about how some of the early activity was focused on the REITs. What were they looking to achieve? I mean, was it mergers? Was it take privates? Kind of what was driving that activity then?
Yeah, so we worked on a significant proportion of all the go privates in the 2005 to 2007 between my co-founder June and with Lisa, my current partner, is that we had worked on so many of them. And a lot of them, it could be for strategic reasons, a lot of them financial buys, and where they're looking to take it or to take advantage of a spread between public and private pricing. There was a lot of that. But the dynamics are that if you think about it, and the conversation is different, in the public markets, there is only so many things you can negotiate in a contract, right? It's a public process. There's only so many things. And the folks that are in a public company going private, they're not always the people that built the business or they founded the business, right? The conversation is about stock options and it's about, you know, salary and bonuses and performance targets. Whereas in the private markets, it's about carried interest. And it's about promotes. And it's about, I built this business and I care about working capital adjustments. And so it's a very different kind of dialogue. And I find the attachment point and what folks are looking for in their deals doesn't necessarily always align. I mean, they all want to optimize value for the companies, sure. But it's how you evaluate looking at that and the decision points that go into it that I think are different. So in private markets, you know, every deal we've worked on doesn't look anything like the deal we did before. There's always nuances. You care about survival rights. You care about what happens post-contract. A lot of times our clients are staying on. And the goal is they're doing it strategically and they're looking for a partner as opposed to a financial out. And so those are very, very different things that I think that separate those two different kinds of deals. And what it often means is that private company deals are hard. They're hard, particularly if they're strategically driven, because it's also culture becomes increasingly important. It's not always the number one factor that rises to the top in a transaction, but it always ultimately is the number one. It might start that way, but it always is. And I think and it's a fancy word for, will our integration go well, right? If there's no culture alignment, you tend to have problems. So those kinds of things, it's the intangibles that I think are very, very important in private company versus what I often saw before in the public company deals.
So you started your career at a period when the theme was take privates of REITs. How would you contrast that to what you're seeing in the markets today? Obviously, we're recording this in April of 2024, and the kind of big recent news was the Blackstone take private of American Income REIT. I don't know if that is representative of what you're seeing, but help us understand kind of what today's market environment looks like.
Yeah. And look, the public markets, it's an interesting time because when I was at Lehman and Wachovia before, the markets were very hot and pricing was high. And in some instances, you know, the spread and the arbitrage between the public and private was the opposite of what we're seeing in some instances now. And I think the public markets with pricing where it is, particularly for REITs, it creates some interesting dynamics as to what to do with those companies that are public. And I think, you know, it's you've got where we particularly like to work with REITs, it's how to grow your business. If you're a public company, how can you take advantage of the opportunities that are still out there, knowing where the public markets are, pricing is down across the board on a versus an NAV, and capital is harder to come by than ever since the GFC. What can you do in that environment? And so if you're a services company, how do you broaden your services, right? If you're accessing and you need capital to do transactions, can you leverage private capital to do that? And that's where I think we can be very helpful on our background of the private markets and relationships with direct relationships with limited partners, as well as with fund managers, as providing an alternative source of capital to help public companies think about and how to continue to grow their businesses despite the environment.
It's interesting. And I guess maybe now's a good time to kind of back up and make sure that we kind of fully understand what it is that CenterCap does. I think you described it to me as there's kind of three stools or three pillars to your business. Help us understand that, because we've been, you know, focusing on kind of the early lessons learned based on working with public REITs, but I think there's more to it than that.
So we've always been an M&A shop on, particularly with respect to managers and by the real estate investment managers. And that's been our backbone of our business since we started. And that was coming from CB and understanding that we really understood how the fund management business worked. We understood how carry worked. We understood how promotes worked. And we knew how to look at assets with that in mind. And so with that knowledge, we had built it up because we thought we could be a stronger, more tactical advisor to the fund management universe from a strategic perspective, not necessarily from a financial one. Those deals, I think, are a lot easier to do. So we built around that. But that's been expanded. So we'll work with owners, operators, services companies, as well as we'll look at REITs, fund managers. If it's a corporate perspective, we can look at it as a buy, sell, reorganization, et cetera. But we have a capital raising business, again, built from a philosophy from CB that we understood how to raise joint venture capital, how to think about partnerships and structuring those kinds of deals. And we knew a lot of people. And so we've always done single asset. We've moved into programs. We now do a separate account relationship, capital raises, and we'll do top-ups on private placements. And that business has evolved, and it's nuanced too, because the investors that you tap for that business are not the same, right? So your fund management universe, which we had a really good handle on, that's not the same folks that we focus on now for JVs and for programs, SMAs. Those we want to be more direct to the limited partner. So that's targeting pensions, foundations, endowments, large-scale family offices, sovereign wealth, and insurance companies. So we invested some capital and resources in building out that franchise for us. And so it's allowed us to offer our broader set of capital raising capabilities to our clients. So we've developed that. The newer practice, which we started a few years ago, was on the consulting side. And that is really helping all of those constituents how to grow their business or how to deploy capital in the real estate sector. And so it could be a client that's a fund manager and says, I want to grow to 5 to 10 billion. How do I do it? All right. And that's a loaded question because you're talking about organization, resources, governance, product development, all of those things and structuring it so that you're creating opportunities and ideas that actually have value. You know, there are firms that can create ideas, but nobody wants them. So they have limited utility. And we expand that onto the pension and insurance community too, and using our knowledge of underwriting corporates and saying, hey, look, we can help you think about corporate preferred GP investing by helping you drill down and understanding what makes companies tick and how to grow them so that you can underlie good managers. And that skill is more important than ever because the past 10 years, we've had folks that have great track records. Everyone has a great track record, right? Money's been free for a long time. And the real question we ask now is, if I take away your track record, what's your story? What's your story? And it's striking how many owners, operators, managers do not have a good answer to that. They've relied on a strong track record for 10 years. But if you take it away, what do you stand on and how do you separate yourself from the competition?
Let me pause there. I'm curious to know, because, you know, I think in the industry, we often joke that everybody believes that they're so uniquely different. But if you're an investor or an allocator, the prevailing thesis is that everyone kind of looks the same. And I think track record's a good example. So Like, what's an example of a good story and a not so good story? And, you know, you can attribute it to specific firms or not, but just like in a sense, like, help us understand what that means. Do you have a good story to stand on?
Yeah, I think it, for us, whenever we work with clients, it's to break down their company. We deconstruct them down to understand what makes them tick, and then take the best of who they are and weave it so that an investor feels connected to the story and can tell who you are by what they read. And it's a lot harder than it sounds, because a lot of folks, for example, will say we're top down or we're bottoms up and we're research driven. But what do you mean by that? And so giving and creating connectivity that's real and is centered on something, I think, is meaningful. Or if you're going to talk about, like, for example, case studies, it's like, you know, people often put their repackaged and, you know, their repackaged picture of what they've turned around their company and what it now looks like today. What did it look like before? Walk me through exactly what you did, and create a connection with who your audience is, because the perception should always be is your materials should represent who you are as a company and what your story is, but it needs to stand on its own. So can I give your story to an investor, and will they understand who you are off the pages? And will they be able to understand what you stand for as a company? And getting into that, and whether it's, you know, it's taking your properties or taking your team, there's always nuances to every company. And it's really getting a good handle on what that culture is, how they run their business, how they do their policies, how they compensate, how they come up with their strategy, how they do their underwriting. It's not always the same, but what happens is companies fall into the trap of being high level about it. And so then you do look the same, right? But if you break it down, there's always more than what meets the eye. It's like there's no two people are the same. People are different, but it's really getting to know the company and figuring out what those differences are and the things that define them, and then creating a story and translating it onto paper. It is not easy.
So does that imply that at the end of the day, this is really about a human-to-human connection versus a financial, you know, if you assume that, you know, the baseline is good financial returns, good track record. We hear a lot about the importance of relationships. And it sounds like a lot of what you're saying is being able to connect with your end buyer, your end partner, your end XYZ. Is it really about that, or is it about something else? And maybe this is like a derivative of a bigger question of, you know, when you're advising your clients on the buy side, like what is the role of real estate in their portfolio? And like, why do these relationships matter so much here? Whereas in maybe a traditional venture transaction or private equity transaction, there's a different flavor of what people are looking for.
I think that whether it's buy side, sell side, or capital raising. And look, I've spoken to, I don't know how many investors this week, but it's a lot. And the recurring theme always is, it's that this is a relationship business. And in an environment where capital raising is very challenging, you have to be able to separate your story from other people's stories. Because, you know, who wants to take on a new manager, or a new owner operator, a new JV, or a new SMA if you already have somebody that fills their slot? You have to have something that's unique and something that can thread the needle between the other things that they have. But equally important in that, it's that opportunities don't sell themselves. They don't. You have to have someone that can market them. And I can bring people to the table, sure. But at the end of the day, it's up to whoever is responsible, who's going to be the GP, who's the ultimate partner. It's on them to convince and to work with the investor that they're the ones that they should work with. So it's coming across with relationships. How authentic you are. Do you believe in your strategy? How do you run your company? How do you select markets? How do you underwrite? All these, and there are very different answers to those things. If you cut through, we have a checklist and we're research driven. If you take away those things and you start really drilling down into companies, companies do look at those things differently. But I'll tell you, I had a conversation with a very large pension plan last week, who told me that a significant proportion of how they do business is based on relationship. So you're not going to invest only for a relationship, or I wish they did, but you've got to have a good idea. But a good idea without an authentic, a credible management team, I'm not sure that's going to be any more successful than a great team without a great idea.
So let's talk about some specifics. I think we hear a lot about having a great relationship, having, you know, really good communication, being able to convey your points of differentiation. What are kind of a few of the things that if I were a client looking to raise institutional capital or find an institutional capital partner at a high level, like what are a few of the principles that are really important for somebody who's a GP to think about?
So from the GP perspective, when we are looking at working with pensions, et cetera, and on underwriting corporates and GPs, what I always tell them is they could be a great team, but there are a lot of great teams that are around right now who, particularly if you measure them on track record. And I just had this conversation yesterday. It's yes, but do we believe this team is going to get you out of a pickle when the pickle arises? Because in this environment where everything is hard, transactions are hard, structuring is hard, raising capital is hard, running a company is hard. It's how do you figure out and measure whether that company has the right people that can figure that out, right? And that is more, that comes back to the point I was making about track record. It has been so much easier over the past decade where given where pricing has and given where the capital markets have been, that you haven't had to work as hard. And so, you know, one thing that's distinguishing is have you been around after or before 2009? That's a good point. What were you doing before 2009, right? And now looking at if things go sideways, assessing or being able to assess how you would handle it. And that is hard to do. It's, you know, I've been fortunate enough. I've worked with a lot of companies. So I've got a pretty good nose for it. But it's poking around and figuring out if you have confidence that if something goes sideways, something on construction, there's an issue with a contractor, or it's, you know, something you have an overrun, or, you know, something happens with the pool, you know, is this the right team that can figure that out and keep you on track? And it's harder than ever to assess that when there isn't as many bars to evaluate it on.
So I think that's a really interesting point, and it came up two times in different meetings I was at last week at IREI and ULI, this idea of track record. And I think, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's an interesting philosophical conversation because on one hand, if you were around and super successful pre-2009, almost definitionally, you're at the middle to kind of later stages of your career journey. And there's a lot of critiques. You know, if you're at the end of your career, what does succession look like? And if you started your career in earnest post-2009, then you don't get credit for a track record that you built. So at some level, it's a kind of existential crisis of, does the industry want to support new blood, new operators, or is this all about kind of recapitalizing the existing players with new teams and leaning on existing brands? I don't know. There's probably a lot more to it, but I'm curious to kind of get your take on this conundrum because it comes up in every meeting. And you know, going back to last week in one of the conversations, two or three investors said, I cannot give you credit for your track record in the last 7 to 10 years, because if it wasn't up and to the right, something's really wrong. So everybody was up and to the right. So what do you look at? How do you get credit?
Yeah, I think for pre, and I don't always look at it as a 2009, and therefore, if you haven't been around since then, it's not great. I don't. But what I do when I work with clients, if that is the case, well, let's talk about what you were doing before 09, right? You know, 5 years ago, would anyone have done that? No. So now it's like, what were you doing? Is let's talk about that background. And it comes down to credibility. I don't think it always has to be a track record pre-9, but you have to convince me you're credible and that you can figure it out. And it's just easier if you've been around since before 09 and you have a track record. I certainly don't rule it out when we look at client selection. I think we have a really good nose for picking good clients, good management teams with great ideas. And part of that is not getting too bogged down in a certain metric that I have to look at or not look at. But I'll tell you on that point, though, it's that I am seeing more of pensions, fund managers and vehicles popping up that are backing and looking to back smaller stage companies and help them grow. And more, it's the model of putting a little bit of capital into the corporate, a preferred working capital line, give some GP dollars, and then providing a check to grow the business to companies that are earlier infancy on the basis that they believe they're strong, credible management teams with a great idea.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about some of the trends. I think what you just referred to is interesting. What does that mean if you're the manager and you're taking some of that capital? Are you typically giving up control? Like, what are you getting in return other than an investment at the opco?
It depends on who it is, and it depends on exactly where they are, because there are investors who will look at both control as well as non-controlling positions. If they look at the corporate and they are looking for different things. Sometimes, and it's no different in some ways in the fund management model, some of them are looking for a cash yield. So they have to own properties or have access to properties that are cash yielding. Some of them are in it for the capital appreciation. And some of them want to lock in the idea and lock up the owner operator within that product. And a classic right now is cold storage, right? Cold storage is a sector that historically has not been hugely driven by institutional dollars. It's become a much more popular as we're focused on last mile logistics, especially. And so there's a lot more talk about cold storage today than there was 3 years ago. But part of that dialogue has been too, that, you know, who are the owner operators? You know, 75% of the market is controlled by, you know, less than a handful of big players. And then everything else is scattered. But that for real estate, that's great. That smells like an opportunity to me. It's like, can we find a good operator and maybe take a sharpshooter approach to a market, right? We're seeing a lot more interest in those kinds of opportunities. And then what you do is you provide capital to tie them up on the LP side. And then it's a question really to think about, do you want to be locked in with one investor? Because to me, if you do that, you can make a lot of money, but you don't really create platform value, right? Because too much of it is tied up in the one partner. Or do you use it to leverage it to have other partners? And then what is the price of that? I think there are some corporate investors who like the idea of wanting control of the LP dollars. And there's some who will openly encourage a push, but not control. And then there's obviously the folks that are in the corporate that will want different things attached to their dollars. And it's an exciting time because, you know, I remember a time where there were no GP deals. It was a new word. And we were one of the early promoters of that as a concept. And there was, I could count on one hand how many folks would look at a GP, you know, program back then. And here we are today, it's much more common. But again, those things, as well as the owner, this operator model, are very nuanced and comes down to who the manager is and exactly what they're looking for and what they have already.
So I think that's interesting. And we talked about that on an earlier episode as well with some other guests. And I think it's a theme we'll continue to visit on the distribution podcast and show. I think one of the things, if you Google your name and your firm name, Center Cap, you know, you'll see you've also done some kind of corporate level, kind of minority, or maybe they're even majority kind of ownership transitions, acquisitions, straight up acquisitions in the more traditional sense. When you're talking to a large insurance company or, you know, a public company looking to acquire a private company, kind of what are some of the themes that you're hearing that's driving the buy side of these larger kind of majority acquisition deals that you're involved with?
So I think the industry more broadly is going through a lot of change. And we've been very active on the M&A side for managers over the past 2-3 years. And that is largely driven by, I think, there's a lot of inflow of folks looking to come into the industry that have traditionally were not there. And insurance companies is one of them. You know, we had written more than once about the role of insurance companies in real estate investment market, being around perpetual capital and being there as a mechanism for managers to create long-term value for their organizations. And that's held up to be true. So we can look around now, and that's turned out to be the case. And we did one of our first early deals was with Allied World, who acquired a minority interest in Blue Vista. And I think that is, again, insurance companies look to get involved in the real estate space for different reasons. But at the corporate level, a couple of them are, is that they want access to the real estate and they want access to how deals are underwritten, more intellectual knowledge around the sector, but they really don't want to own the whole thing and they don't want to control position because it's not their expertise. They understand they're not a real estate team, but they want access all the same. And then there's insurance companies that are actively building out their own investment management divisions. And they do want to control it. And they do want to use it to push their general account dollars into those as a mechanism to seed or to help grow those businesses in-house. And we're definitely seeing more of those. There's a whole bunch of them that exist today, particularly the larger insurance companies. But I think them, alts is doing exactly the same thing. I think we'll end up seeing the RIA community as well. Maybe some of the banks venturing back into, particularly on the private credit side. But as a result, I think there's a lot more folks coming into it, and that is driving demand for the managers. And for us, it's great because, you know, we think we're real estate specialists and we think we're very tactical at understanding the universe and understanding who, what kind of company, what kind of manager fits specifically for what your ask is. So folks that usually will come to us is, we want to get into real estate. Now, what do we do? That's how it goes. It's, well, okay, well, let's think about that. And so it's, those are the kinds of exciting opportunities because the management space is so diverse. It's diverse in investors, diverse in product, diverse in risk profile, and diverse in management teams. And so you really have to dig in across all of those avenues to figure out where there's a good strategic fit for anyone.
And besides insurance companies, and you touched on RIAs, and we can spend more time there if you'd like, kind of where are the other pools of capital that are looking to acquire minority or majority interest in GPs in real assets today?
Yeah, I think those folks, and particularly we're seeing more even on the minority side, on the investing side. You know, 5 years ago, there probably wasn't that many. Everything was a controlled position, you know, and I think Allied was ahead of its time in how they thought about investing in the real estate space. And I think that now there's more funds, there's more managers, there's more mandates to take minority interest positions in companies. And it's not always for the same reason. Folks do deals for all kinds of reasons. And it just, again, it comes down to, you know, what is it you're specifically trying to achieve with your deal? And the ones I actually think probably more challenging is when you're looking at strategic partnerships and you're looking at 50-50 relationships where both sides are looking to contribute. Those deals, I think, are harder to work with because it's evaluating what each brings to the table, but still being able to assess, you know, how do you create value out of for yourself? You know, for a strategic advisor like us, what we focus on, not only can you make money, but does it create value for your platform? Those are two very different questions with different answers. And so those ones I always find interesting when folks want to look at them. I'm not always sure that they're as successful as just being clear and mandate of it's minority or it's majority. I think there's a lot more nuances on the strategics where you're going to do something 50-50 and each is supposed to be bringing something to the table.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. You know, there was a recent RIA transaction with one of our clients. You can kind of Google it. It's in the press. What do you think is driving the RIAs wanting to kind of have captive GPs? Do you believe that, you know, this is a byproduct of market maturity where, you know, perhaps the RIAs don't have the ability to kind of evaluate the totality of options? And so it's just a lot easier to have a captive option where they can become subject matter experts and specialists, or is something else driving this? And I'm curious because there's a lot of talk about private wealth and the wealth channels and the amount of capital that's coming into the space. What is your, you know, if you look into your crystal ball, how do you think that kind of private wealth, non-institutional, obviously private, will evolve over the next decade?
I think that is one of the most interesting trends that we're seeing. It's, if you think about it for a minute, it's, everyone has focused on raising institutional dollars. It's the holy grail, big checks, big dollars, big funds. And the world has gravitated that way. And to the point, you know, we have clients that have non-institutional products. They've raised, you know, $200-300 million for it. It's driven through the RIA network. And they're like, well, we want to move into the institutional product. And my question right now is why? Why do you want to do that? Right? You can raise billions of dollars through, and many companies have, by channeling through the RIA network. It's a different, again, it's a different kind of investor. It requires a different kind of infrastructure and capital formation capability. But it all comes down to, what product do you have? What is your expertise? And there are products that are considered non-institutional, either because it's small products, it could be high, it's in B markets or C products and C markets, but are cash flowing great, right? But for a big institution, they may not be interested in that. And similarly, if they're small checks, it is hard for the bigger institutions to look at those because you can't deploy the capital that they need to deploy. But I've come to a place where I think those products are just fine. And you can create value for your business and you can make money by focusing on an RIA network. The first question you have to ask is, what is your strength? What is your capability? And what do you do as the core of your business? Because if you're going to try and take a non-institutional product and make it institutional, you may be talking about an entire new team. Your portfolio manager may not be right. Your asset manager, maybe your acquisition, your original, none of it may be right, right? All because, for example, you are in multifamily, it doesn't mean you can take a high net worth product and make it institutional. It just doesn't work that way, right? So you really got to think about what suits and where your skill and base is. And we see plenty of managers that have RIA sleeves, particularly on the credit side, and actually on anything that has a smaller check size as a product. And those are very successful. And I realize they could be painful to manage that channel, given the size of the checks. But maybe the question should be, how can we do this more efficiently? Or maybe, you know, the RIA universe isn't uniform either. Maybe you need to rethink how you're attacking the sector and the size and the types of investors you're focused on. But Brandon, come to your second question, which I think is also a very good question. It's, if you think about it from the RIA universe, if we appreciate there's a whole host of real estate products that support the RIA network, you got to ask yourself that we have consultants and managers of institutional capital that already have their own fund products themselves. So if it's already there and have already dealt with the concepts of conflicts and managing and giving advice vis-a-vis having my own products, then I don't, to me, I think it's a natural thought, well, why can't the RIA channel do it? Well, why can't you offer both if an institutional consultant can have funds and offer, do separate accounts? It's the same kind of concept. It's just a different audience. And so it's a real question is, you know, because the first question you always get is for RIAs, well, we can't do that because of the conflict. And I always ask the question back, well, that question's already been asked and answered. Right? Is that folks manage the conflicts all the time in real estate. And the question shouldn't be, why can't I? The question should be, well, what do I need to do in order to manage the risk and the exposure and the conflict? What can I do to address that issue?
I think it's a fascinating topic and one I've spent a lot of time on. And I think, you know, the risk is a big, the risk mitigation is a big part of it. And I agree with you, it can be addressed. I think the other interesting thing that we've observed is that the language that an institutional, you talked about, you know, are you an institutional team? Do you have an institutional portfolio manager? The language that institutional GPs use is very different than the language that a non-institutional GP would use to talk to their investors. And the irony is the asset itself may be sold from a fundless sponsor, a syndicator with retail capital to a institutional fund manager, but everything else, the way you think about underwriting returns, the language you use, the purpose or the reason for acquisition and disposition is totally different. And so, you know, it's really fascinating to kind of look at these two worlds. You've talked a lot about enterprise value or value. And this, like you, I've been in the business for nearly 20 years. And when we think about kind of value, historically, it's been discussed in the value of an asset or the performance of a fund. But I think what we're talking about today is the value of your organization, your enterprise. What does that mean? And how do you think about the drivers of enterprise value?
Yeah, I think a lot of fund managers, owner operators, you know, tie their belief of value in an organization to carried interest or promotes or what did they get at the asset level. And they shouldn't. It's interesting and it's supportive, but it's not definitive. And so let's take an example of a manager that has one fund series and they're continually on the treadmill. You get on the treadmill, you raise capital, you do fees, you sell your assets, and then you start all over again. Those companies, it is harder to create platform value vis-a-vis someone that offers two products. And why is that? Because for fund managers, you're underwriting fee streams, right? So you make money off carried interest, but you create value by underwriting a fee stream. So if a buyer is going to come in, they're going to look at, well, what is my earnings and what is the recurring nature of those earnings? And can I leverage those earnings to grow the business? Carried interest comes and goes and it's risky, right? And so it's harder for a buyer to underwrite that type of risk. And if they're willing to underwrite that risk, it is certainly not going to be on the same basis that they underwrite your recurring earnings. And so a lot of times how you look at it from a valuation of a manager is to what is the value of your recurring earnings being the operating business? What is, how do I look at your investment return, which is your carry interest? And how do those two line up? And so if you think about it with your treadmill approach with the one fund manager, that recurring fee stream comes and goes, right? It goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. Versus if you have multiple products, you can create some consistency. So in terms of managers, what you're really trying to do is you're trying to create multiple products, a breadth of investors that you have, and you focus on geography, right? And it doesn't mean you have to be international, but how do you think about geography? Are you a sharpshooter? Can you go beyond that? Can you create a product that targets a market? We always focus on products in terms of a risk profile or in terms of type, but can you do it on a geography? Right? And so there's different ways to look at it, but the ultimate goal is to have a lot of balls up in the air, right? The more balls up you have in the air, then the more that you can create fee streams that someone can underwrite with a greater clarity, because recurring fee streams are worth more than non-recurring fee streams.
So would that mean that we should expect to see kind of more vertical integration in the allocator model on the GP side where they're generating additional fee streams as well?
Yeah, we've seen that as a trend since the GFC. You know, I think the world used to be much more in terms of diversification and greater, broader reach and broader access. And I think from the GFC through to today, you've seen that sharpshooter model. So there's a lot more multifamily streams, retail vehicles, office vehicles, industrial vehicles, self-storage vehicles, right? There's a lot more of these specialty products. And I think in part it's because you can cross-sell to the same investor two different products, right? So why put it all on the one vehicle and just sell them one, whereas you can market more than one thing and really establish your relationship with that investor so they don't have to look around and look for other managers and other folks that are out there. And so we've definitely seen that. But then your next question you've raised is the logical one. Well, if I'm going to be a sharpshooter in multifamily, well, how do I do that without creating a greater degree of attachment to the asset? And that's where that vertical integration has come into play. It's, you know, greater access has usually been translated in terms of I have to manage it. Right. And there's always that balance of around, well, at what point do you need to manage your own assets? It's as if you're only managing 10,000 units, does it make sense? Well, it depends on where they are. But if you have 100,000 units, should you be outsourcing that property management and paying your managed property management fees? Do the economics at that point mean that they become, it should be an internally driven function? And I think that debate is ongoing. But what I do feel comfortable is, you know, we just announced the sale of BH to Pretium back in February. And BH managed, you know, something like 115,000 units. And I think what that deal was a testament to, it's that this piece around vertical integration and having an attachment that's closer to the asset is real, and that the value of platforms that are in that services aspect have garnered a lot of attention and have impacted the value perceived of those enterprises over a period of time. And so, you know, where there was a time where property management was viewed more as a commodity service, I think that view has definitely evolved. And there's definitely folks that think that, particularly by ones who don't manage their own product. But there's an increasing number of folks that believe you have to manage your own asset if you really want to control your own properties and then benefit from the synergies that you can get from that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I hear both sides of the story. I think, you know, we've also observed the trend towards vertical integration as a kind of opco income, fee income stream. On the flip side, one of the big trends that I'm curious to get your thoughts on is this idea of sector specialist or sharpshooters, where the big will continue to get bigger and they're very diversified and they will continue to have more fee income coming in, which is quite valuable. The middle could get squeezed because, you know, oftentimes they're neither vertically integrated nor specialist and sharpshooters, but they might have a handful of products. And then the sector specialists are where you can go to get your exposure to those niche sectors that you've referenced, like cold storage, for example, that we've discussed today, or self-storage or manufactured housing or medical office, any of the things that are seen as alpha generating. So at some level, it seems like these things are at odds with each other. Like, how can you be a sector specialist, generate enterprise value without losing your sector specialism, if that makes sense, or specialty, I should say?
Yeah, well, I think what you end up doing is, so let's just take multifamily. And I think this is a trend too, when you start talking about niche products, is that multifamily, if someone comes to me and they have a multifamily product, I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? Like, multifamily has become very diverse and it takes on a lot of different personas now, right? And it's branched out into a lot of different buckets. I mean, we've seen the rise of custom, you know, purpose-built student housing, right? There is military housing. There is active adult living. There's manufactured housing, affordable housing, market rate housing, workforce housing. I mean, we can go on and on and on. But the question is that can you take any one of those realms, create a sister product that your skills still work for as a manager, so you can still have one more than one product? Can you target different income brackets? Maybe I'll target this one where they earn $110,000. Maybe this one, it's $75,000. Maybe I'll focus on cities. Maybe I'll focus on secondary cities. There's a lot of different nuances to it. And I think, you know, folks that have started out with like that kind of specialty that did multifamily, it's now they're creating products and looking at ways. This is where we help them, is come up with ways to create multiple products off your expertise. And you can replicate that. I mean, if you're a multifamily today, it's, you know, you can start stretching out and move into other products, but you keep it within, here's one lane. And if you're going to do another division, you can have a product you can replicate, but in a different product class. But I think that's right. And I think what's really interesting now with niche products, and we're seeing it around, if you think active adult living is a classic, right? Where it used to be just senior housing. And now it was like, well, there's senior housing, but there's about five different types of senior housing. And now we've got active adult living, right? Which has popped up in the past 2-3 years. And the great thing about all of these nuanced throw-offs or these new branch outs, it's that you have really smart management teams that have a new way of looking at something very specific. And then they're looking at, well, how do I make the economics work around that? And then you can take that idea and talk to investors, because it's creating a space for yourself. It's a space, right? If you're just going to try and do what everybody else is doing, it's harder. But if you're in the business, it's like, can I come up with something that threads or creates an opportunity that fits within around other opportunities that are out there?
I think it's fascinating. And these adjacencies are directly in line with the trends that we're seeing in the market. Deb, you and I could go on and talk for hours. This is, you know, so fascinating to me. And it's the world that we kind of interact with every day. Obviously, we're not specialists like you are, but we support the clients who are looking to figure out, you know, what to do with their business. So I appreciate your insights and candor. For anyone who's listening or watching this episode on YouTube, and they'd like to learn more about CenterCap, they'd like to get in touch with you, they'd like to, you know, understand your thinking about, you know, how it may relate to their business, what's the best way for them to learn more and or reach out to you?
Yeah, so we're on LinkedIn. You can find us, CenterCap Group. I'm on LinkedIn, Deborah Smith, CenterCap. We have our website as well. Our contact information is on there, as well as some of the pieces we've published, our CCG perspectives on up-and-coming trends and niche things that we see coming through the pipe. And we like to talk about those things, and we think our ideas are fresh and new, and so folks can check those out too.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Deb.
All right. You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.